I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. I'm very excited about my guest today, Tom Philpott. He has been the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones since 2011. Previously, he covered food as a writer and editor for the environmental news website Grist. Philpott's work on food politics has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, and The Guardian, among other places. From 2004 to 2012, he farmed at Maverick Farms in Valle Cruces, North Carolina, and he lives in North Carolina and Austin, Texas. He has a book out called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It, and we're going to talk a bit about that now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really a privilege to be able to talk to you today. You've done just remarkable work and research when it comes to our food system, which we might say is doomed or not, but it's a mess.
It's not looking great right now.
It's not looking
it's
great at all.
It's definitely a mess.
It's a bizarre thing because books like yours, I love. And it's strange that I love them because it just talks about all the mistakes that humans have made over the decades, maybe even longer, and the crisis that we have put ourselves in, and how many just refuse to acknowledge what we're going through. And I love reading about that. And in some bizarre way, it gives me some hope. So let's get started and talk about Perilous Bounty. You focus primarily on California and the Midwest, the Corn Belt, where we get so much of our food. So let's start as you do with California. California is an amazing state. I've lived there. I've commuted there from New York. I still work there quite a bit, except with COVID now, it's kind of stifled the work that I do there. My partner's from San Jose, California. We continually look and think maybe we'll move back there. They grow a lot of food and they grow a lot of the country's food. You talk about a lot that's related to growing the food from California, and we'll touch on some of that. It's not quite the paradise that it looks like or it seems to be.
That's right. It's an incredible place. It's absolutely beautiful. It's got one of the most uniquely, it's got an ecological niche for growing food that is unique in the world. It's one of the world's very few Mediterranean climates, which means that it's basically got warm to super hot summers, depending on where you are, and fairly mild, or in some cases, extremely mild winters. And that means you can grow food year round. One of the problems with growing food in Mediterranean regions is that they tend to be very dry, especially in the summer. California's got that in some ways quite well covered. It's got the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which in addition to being absolutely beautiful, basically capture a lot of the winter weather coming from the South Pacific. It blows over in the form of these big storms, hits the Sierra Nevada, dumps his snow, and creates this incredible, majestic snowpack that, you know, melts in the spring. And there's been this great infrastructure built up by the state government and the federal government to move that snow melt onto farms. And so you got this ideal, almost Edenic situation where you've got a Mediterranean climate plus this incredible stash of water that that comes every year in the form of the snowpack. But there have been some problems with that have emerged. There have been problems with it from the very start, but essentially I think that, you know, the fundamental way that we can put the problem is that in the Central Valley, which is this the place that abuts against the Sierra Nevada Mountains that benefits from all this water, agriculture there has gotten so big and so powerful and so ravenous for water that it's overstripped that resource, that it's using more than that snowmelt generates. Meanwhile, the snowpack has shrunk demonstrably over the past 30 or 40 years because of climate change. And so what farmers in the region have done there, and these aren't, you know, for the most part, with exceptions, small family farms. These are giant farms run by very wealthy people in general. What they've done is that they've reverted to groundwater pumping, to pumping water from these underground aquifers. And they are pumping it at such a dramatic rate that the land is literally sinking and causing you know, all kinds of snarls with infrastructure there. Meanwhile, climate models very convincingly suggest that the Sierra Nevada snowpack will continue shrinking. And so, you know, we as a society have come so reliant on this resource. And what I argue in the book is that we can't rely on it for very much longer.
I lived for the first time in the Bay Area in the mid 80s. I was a chemical engineer and I worked in Silicon Valley. And I accepted the knowledge that earthquakes happened there. Everyone just, okay, there may be a big one sometime. And fortunately, over time, the architecture has been really smart and is built to accommodate a certain size earthquake. Of course, if it's really big, there's nothing much anyone can do, but everybody's accepted that. Right. And it's like a price for the great weather and everything else and the attitude. And then there are the droughts and the fires are worse. I was in the Bay Area for the 2018 fires. Is that when? And it was horrible. It was really scary.
There have been so many bad fire years in recent years that I think they're running together in people's minds.
And then this one isn't even over yet. They're talking about more to come.
And by the time the regular fire season started this year, I think the state had already reached its record. That sort of pre-fire season was absolutely devastating.
It was scary. And I have lots of friends who had to evacuate or had to prepare for evacuation. And now things have settled and they're back to this. Everything's fine again. It's not fine. But then the one thing I didn't know about, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, is the Great Flood.
Yes. Let's talk about the flood.
Nobody talks about the flood.
Yes. Well, it is a very, very strange thing. So I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to the sort of paradox of California weather, is that it's just got a very unique weather situation where, like I said before, the weather in California essentially comes from the South Pacific. It's water that evaporates deep in the South Pacific, thousands of miles away from California. So what you get there is you get the snowpack relies on a very few things that are called atmospheric rivers. And they're called atmospheric rivers because you're talking about water flows from the South Pacific high up in the atmosphere that are essentially as voluminous as rivers. I forget what the number is, but it's in my book, but it's like essentially Mississippi River size flows coming from the South Pacific. And because of climate change, and so the way the weather works there is that in the summer months, there is a high pressure ridge, the meteorologists call it, that hangs around essentially the California coast and pushes all the rain up to the Pacific Northwest. And so that's why California gets very little rain in the summer, because this high pressure ridge sits there and pushes it up to the very rainy, you know, Portland and Seattle regions. But then in the winter, it typically recedes. And so the state relies on, for its snowpack, getting these storms just in a few months in the winter. And if it misses a couple because of climate variation, that's when you get a drought. On the other hand, it sometimes gets really, really big ones. These atmospheric rivers become massive. And they can come and create flooding beyond our ability to imagine. I mean, like sort of put yourself in the space of a Hollywood disaster epic to imagine this. And the reason why I say that is that there was a flood. So California becomes a state in the 1850s after the Gold Rush. It becomes a U.S. state. So U.S. settlers come in, they show up, they start, you know, prospecting for gold. They have their boom in their bust. And in 1861, the gold rush has busted out and people are figuring out, you know, what are we going to do here? San Francisco is establishing itself as the main population center in the state, in the Bay Area. And in the winter of 1861, it starts to rain. And one of these atmospheric rivers blows in and it literally, biblical style, 40 days and 40 nights, doesn't stop. And I say that literally, it was more than 40 days that it was raining. And this flood hits that buries the entire Central Valley. And so this is, the Central Valley you know, starts an hour or two north of Los Angeles and ends, you know, basically at the Oregon border. And it goes down the middle of the state. And it turns the whole thing into a giant inland lake. And it was just inconceivable what happened. And, you know, at the time, it was fairly sparsely settled. There were Native Americans living there. And there are contemporary accounts of Native Americans basically getting the signal, basically based on oral traditions, that something really bad was happening and clearing out, heading to higher ground.
I'm just profoundly amazed at that, that intelligence, that knowledge that we don't have.
Yeah. And then, you know, you had settler agriculture, you had some, you know, cattle agriculture there that gets completely wiped out. Most of it was Mexican nationals. The country had just been taken over. You know, it had been Mexico not very long before that. And most of the farming in the region was cattle ranching by Mexican rancheros. Their ranching gets completely wiped out. Basically, what you get from that is it's very sparsely populated. It was a really big deal. And then it goes away, and California just moved on from it. It just gets buried in the memory of this collective memory.
Out of mind.
Out of sight, out of mind. And I talking to people for the book, I talked to like veteran Californians who are obsessed with California history. They barely, if they knew about it at all, just knew about it really vaguely. Why it's relevant is, you know, it was sort of written off as this sort of freak event, this sort of random, you know, thing that could never happen again. And some incredible scientists started to study things like sediment cores in rivers and lakes in California. And what they found is that floods of that magnitude and floods of even greater magnitude happen regularly in the pre settler history of California before European contact. They happen about every 100 to 200 years. And so let's say about every 150 years. And so this last one occurred about 150 years ago. Statistics don't work such that, you know, we can say we're due for another one right now. However, these are things that happen a lot, and we should know that. But then when you look at climate models, and some of the same scientists talking about the collapsing snowpack, the end of the California snowpack, also talk about how we're going to be getting fewer but larger atmospheric rivers. And the likelihood of one of the 1861, 1862 magnitude in the next 20 years is very high. As this one incredible scientist, Daniel Swain at UCLA, puts it, more likely than not. So in addition to its fires and its earthquakes, California really has to think about floods. And then we as eaters outside of California have to remember that the place where we rely on to get our fruits and vegetables and nuts could literally become a lake. Just one of these winters, maybe even, you know, it's 2020. Who's going to put it past 2020 not to bring a massive flood? Let's hope not. It's a very likely event in our lifetimes in the next 20 years.
So do we have any idea what area of California this flood will cover?
It would take out the Central Valley. One of the things we have to contemplate about that is that we go from it being a very sparsely populated region to now having millions and millions of people, one of the fastest growing regions of California. You know, you've got people fleeing the high, you know, impossibly high rents of the Bay Area and of the Los Angeles metropolitan area. Showing up there, places like Fresno and Bakersfield and Stockton are growing very rapidly. How are we going to get all those people out of there? Agriculture obviously is massive. There's loads and loads of pesticides there. There's loads and loads of animals. And I was talking to one scientist about the size of the modern dairy cow. And, you know, they're way bigger than these sort of beef cows. They were actually leather cows. That was the main market for cows back then. So you got these giant dairy, you know, it's just a really startling thing to contemplate. And then also the Bay Area is mostly spared, but large portions of LA in the models that the U.S. Geological Survey have done, large portions of LA get buried in water, which is also just, you know, really, really hard to contemplate.
Okay, so if I decide to move back to the Bay Area, I only have to worry about earthquakes, fires, and possibly a lack of food, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah,
and not just, really flood. You
know, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be fun for anyone there if that happens. It's going to be, yeah.
Yeah. So in my very privileged world living in New York City through the pandemic, I've had all my organic food delivered here. We use a service called Go Organic NYC. I talked to the owner from time to time, and he was letting me know that broccoli, the price of broccoli was going up because of the California fires. So just keep that in mind. That's just like a little hint.
Yeah.
Of what's possible to come.
Yeah. And it shows you that what happens in California spills over everywhere in terms of food system and food prices.
All right. So that's California.
Yes.
And then we have the Corn Belt. We have the Midwest. They had the Dust Bowl. And who remembers the Dust Bowl? Who learns from it? We created these great pumps so they could suck water out of the aquifers and the problem went away. But it didn't go away. The problem got worse. So let's talk about that.
There's the Corn Belt, and then a little bit to the west of the Corn Belt, there is the High Plains and the Great Plains. And that's mainly where the Dust Bowl happened. And that's mainly where you have a California-like situation of, you know, very dry, like total reliance on pumping water from underground. And there's definitely a massive problem in what was the old Dust Bowl. But my book mostly focuses a little bit east of there on the Corn Belt, since it's like sort of centered in Iowa. Iowa is sort of the California of grain production, of fruit, let's say of corn and soybean production. It's got one of the most ideal conditions for growing these kinds of crops in the world. Iowa agriculture is completely rain-fed to this day. There's no groundwater pumping in Iowa, except for people that drink water. There's no agriculture is non-irrigated. And you get this incredible lush store of topsoil. It's one of the world's like five large prairie-derived soil regions. And what that means is that this is an area that for millennia and millennia, there were large ruminants roaming around, and most places with people living with them, sort of de facto managing them. And you get this ecosystem, this sort of grassland ecosystem that creates this just incredible store of topsoil, of just rich, loamy, you know, gorgeous topsoil. And you get, you know, fairly, you know, nice summers for growing, and then really cold winters. That's the story of the Corn Belt. And the other thing about the Corn Belt, and this is also true of the Central Valley, California, massive amounts of wetlands, huge in northern Iowa, Minnesota, places like that. Wetlands that were incredible engines of biodiversity, avian biodiversity, bird, nursery ground for dozens and dozens of species of birds. And so basically U.S. settler agriculture wipes all that out. I think less than 1% of Iowa's original prairie exists today. You know, you plow the prairie, you drain the wetlands and plow them. Remaining wetlands in the area are a tiny fraction, just like they are in the Central Valley. And over the years, over the decades, there was diversity, there was crop diversity in settler agriculture. You had corn, was always there, but you had oats and you had wheat. Over the decades, all of that gets replaced. Corn stays, everything else gets replaced with soybeans. So now you got two crops, corn and soybeans. And just as they're sucking dry the aquifer in the Central Valley, they're destroying, this kind of agriculture is destroying the soil. It is literally sending the soil gushing into streams and the Mississippi River and carrying it away. And as that happens, you know, you need more chemicals to keep it going. Yields start to drop, and that's already happening in some places, in some patches of the Corn Belt. And once again, we come to the conclusion that this can't keep going on like this. I mean, this agriculture in the Midwest is based on this rich store of topsoil that is literally being consumed by the agriculture. And, you know, whereas California is our fruit and vegetable basket, the Midwest is where meat comes from, because meat, the U.S. industrial meat industry is based on corn and soybean feed. And so unless you're going to the farmer's market and shopping from some, you know, farmer down the road, the meat that you get in the supermarket is, and oftentimes even in a place like Whole Foods, is grown with Midwestern corn and soybeans. And once again, that can't keep going on like it is.
I'm just taking a breath here.
Yes.
Now,
welcome to my world.
Yeah, my world too. I mean, I've been reading and talking about this for decades, at least 30 years or more. These are things we've known about for a long time, how it's very inefficient to grow food, to feed animals, to feed people, and then add lots of toxic pesticides and herbicides. We know, I mean, the science is there to know how to grow food. We need a healthy root system from trees and grasses and beneficial insects. And there's a process that sustains the earth and the food that we grow. And there's a process that doesn't. And right now we're living in this, we're living in a world with too many people in a capitalistic society that just focuses on profit. We have this oligopoly of a handful of companies that are in control of everything that's vertically integrated. They're in control of the seeds, the fertilizers, the equipment, the banking. And so a handful of people are profiting and everybody else is struggling. It just seems like, is there any way out of this crazy structure that we've created?
It's a really good question. And I think the thing about it is very carefully constructed to be hard to get out of, but it is also pretty well propped up by government policy.
Yes.
And theoretically, if there's a bad policy in a democracy, then it can be changed, and we can have a different policy that that does different things. And you know, the great democratic experiment can move on. The problem is that it's completely stalled out because, as I show in the book, these oligopolies that you talk about, they are smart enough to invest some of their profits that they sort of squeeze out of the system into lobbying and campaign finance. And so they become an incredibly powerful force of inertia in Washington policy circles. And, you know, for decades, this has been a bipartisan thing. This has been supported by Democrats and Republicans. Really, you know, entrenched itself in a lot of ways under Bill Clinton, this idea of, you know, producing as much corn and soybeans as possible. And even when farmers lose money because it's way overproduced, well, that's when government subsidies step in and keep the whole thing going. Obama didn't challenge it fundamentally. Like so many things in our society, Donald Trump has taken it to an extreme, and he's sort of done his specialty of saying the quiet parts out loud. And so, you know, when, you know, basically the past couple of years, he has taken the system that basically pays farmers to grow as much corn and soybeans as possible and accelerated it to, you know, extreme levels, essentially parachuting cash into Iowa to maintain the status quo. He's had various excuses for these like multi-billion-dollar bonuses that farmers have gotten in the past couple of years. First, it was this trade war. Then it was the COVID-19 crisis. Then it was, I don't even know what the last, I mean, I think the current one is basically he's got an election coming up, and that's, you know, basically the rationale for it. The hope that I have is that things have gotten so extreme and people are starting to realize just how crucial adapting to climate change is, because it's no longer something that is 20 years in the future. It's something that's happening right here and right now, that I think that there's an opening in a Biden administration for change. And you know, if the Democrats get the Senate, I don't think Biden has instincts of someone who wants to shake things up. It's just not the way that he is. But I think that there, you know, he is facing, if he wins and the Democrats take the Senate, he's going to be facing so many multiple crises that I think that he's going to have very little choice but to do something like a big Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. That is going to, you know, I mean, I think that the idea was pretty exotic when it started a few years ago when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out with it. But I think now with climate and the economic collapse that we're seeing happening so simultaneously, a policy that takes care of both at the same time will be something that's very attractive. And in fact, he's got stuff in his platform. He doesn't say the words Green New Deal, but he's got a green jobs program. And I think it's crucial that agriculture be part of that. And it's crucial that the climate crisis wake people up that, hey, this policy that we have of maximum production of corn and soybeans and just maximum, we can talk about federal water policy and the impact it has in California, but maximum water to these oligarchic outfits in the Central Valley, it's not working anymore. And we're going to have to do something different. So I do see space for change opening, but that is the only way we're going to see change, and that's policy change.
I think it's important to identify the difference between the farmers and the workers.
Yeah.
Because there are small farmers that are in the ground and doing the dirty work, and then there are these other farmers, the mid-sized farms and then the giant ones, and we have this romantic image of a farmer, but the workers are negatively impacted even more to some degree than some of the farmers.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. And I think this, you know, one of the many, many things that the pandemic has exposed is just what a burden is placed on farm workers. We're seeing all over the country, we're seeing outbreaks of COVID-19 among farm workers. And, you know, basically, I think whenever you see an outbreak that hits workers, and you see it happening over and over again, what you're witnessing is a really stunning lack of worker power. Witnessing is workers who are being ruthlessly exploited, and we see that in meatpacking plants, and we see it on farms. And I think that it's going to be also really important, and a really big push we're going to have to have. Is to revalue farm labor. It can't be this thing that only the very lowest wages possible are to be diverted to farm labor. Most labor laws that were won in the New Deal will accept, you know, to this day, exclude farm labor. I think all that has to change, and I think there's opportunity for it. And something that Trump did that has gotten too little attention, I did a piece on it for Mother Jones. He basically did a bureaucratic machination to cut the wages of guest farm workers. And we're talking in, you know, it's the wages are set state by state. And they give guest farm workers a higher than minimum wage just to make sure that bringing in guest farm workers doesn't reduce wages in the area. They say, okay, you can't undercut low wage labor. And so every state has a set minimum wage for guest workers. Trump has been, and his USDA secretary, Senator Perdue, has been, you know, openly talking about cutting this wage. It's kind of hard to do. And they found a bureaucratic trick. There's a survey that they use to, the USDA does to figure this out. They just stopped doing the survey. And the reporting that I did was just by doing that, basically HOA worker wages revert to minimum wages in every state as low as $7.25 per hour in some states. You're talking about a 50%, 30, 40, 50% pay cut for the people feeding us during a pandemic. And I think that mentality has got to end. I absolutely agree with you about that.
Yeah, well, I read your article, Did Trump Just Cut Guest Farm Worker Wages by as Much as 50% on motherjones.com. I recommend everybody go to it. I shared it on my social media platforms. And when the pandemic started here in New York City, we were out on our terrace every day doing the applause at 7 p.m. And I thought about all those essential workers. And you know, I don't make a lot of money, but I'm willing to pay a little bit more for my food so that everybody has a living wage and can live healthfully and send their children to school and have health insurance and all that stuff. The last thing I want to talk about, I like to call it the elephant in the room, and that's the livestock. I've been a vegan for 30 years. Primarily, it's because I didn't want to kill animals for food. And then reading Diet for New America by John Robbins and lots of subsequent books, I learned about confined animal feedlot operations and the lakes of manure that are going into our water supply and how inefficient it is to grow plants to feed animals, to feed food, and how we're learning that humans should eat primarily plants, maybe a little bit of animal products, but not a lot, and it's affecting our chronic diseases. So I'm quite passionate about that. And I like to align with people who are against the factory farming concept, which is so inefficient, horrific. Well, it's considered efficient, but not considering the future of our soil or sustainability or the quality of our water or air or the health of the people. But I like to work with people who agree with the things that I agree with on those issues, which are so important. And you mentioned in your book, Christopher Leonard, who wrote The Meat Racket, and Ted Genovese, who wrote The Chain. I've talked to them both on this program. I love their books, similar doomsday, doom and gloom kind of things, but with a hope for the future if we can get it together and change. So my first question is, why is it okay to eat meat?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I, you know, as an animal lover, we may have just heard my dog on this podcast running around. I totally get that question. I think that ultimately the answer lies in that it's really hard. The best kind of agriculture, the most robust, ecologically efficient agriculture combines livestock, combines animals and plants. And I think that it makes sense to, you know, lots and lots of societies over time have had meat in their diets. Not everyone has. I don't think you need to have a healthy diet at all. But I think you can have a healthy diet with meat. I think it can add, you know, needed nutrition. I think that is basically a personal choice. But what I will say is that the level of meat that we eat in the United States, which is around per person around 220 pounds, which is more than half a pound a day. There is no way that you could do an ecologically robust, you know, mixed agriculture and produce that much meat. And I think that the best analyses I've seen of this question, there's this guy named Vasab Smil. He's up in Canada. And he estimates that, you know, basically if you kept meat production to pasture where you can't grow food, where you can't grow crops, I should say, and or rotating animals through pasture, like, you know, basically it would make a lot of sense to rotate animals through the past, you know, through the prairies of the Midwest. That would make a lot of sense. They've basically stopped that they've combined them all into these feedlots. But it would make sense to get them back out there again. And if you fed them, you know, like waste products, you know, hogs and chickens can live on waste products. I think that the per capita consumption of meat globally would be something like 0.2 pounds a day. So instead of 0.6 pounds a day, 0.2 pounds a day. So that would mean Americans cutting their meat consumption by a third. And in some parts of the world where there's a lot of poverty, it would possibly mean increasing meat consumption a little bit, but it would be a lot less meat than we have right now. And so that's why, did you ever see that thing I did in, I think it was back in 2010, I declared a vegan omnivores alliance against factory farming.
Yes, I was curious as to how that went.
You know, I still got a lot of help from vegans.
we're angry.
I also made a lot of vegan friends. A lot of, you know, I've had a lot of conversations like the one we're having right now. So that's why I appreciate anyone who doesn't eat meat, because anyone who doesn't eat meat right now is contributing to bringing down that ridiculously high per capita meat consumption that we have. And I think efforts to, you know, ask people to cut down and to figure out ways of making meat into something that isn't, you know, a giant pork chop at the center of my plate for every meal, but as people say, like as a flavoring or a seasoning or an accent in a dish, I think all these efforts are great. And I feel like in my work, I, over the years, sometimes do recipes and talk about cooking. I'm a, you know, very someone who very much likes to cook. I feel like I've encouraged that. I've done some meat dishes in those recipes. I've also done plenty of vegan dishes and vegetarian dishes, and also dishes that de-emphasize meat but have a little meat. So, you know, I think, you know, I'm very much in favor of this vegan omnivores alliance, and I feel like we're having a meeting of it right now.
Yes. Well, my dream is a vegan world where nothing is exploited. No life form is exploited in any way. That's humans, animals, the planet. I don't know that we'll ever get there. Humanity may come to an end soon. Who knows? But that's my dream.
I respect that. And I think that, you know, you can do really good agriculture without animals, and you could even have.
Yeah, I've spoken with a lot of veganic agriculture folks that do quite well without using any animal additions.
You can use nitrogen fixing cover crops and things like that. And also, you know, you could even do animals rotating in fields and doing ecological things and not eat them. I can envision that kind of thing happening where, well, I rotate cows through my fields, you know, a couple times a year, but I just use the same cows and let them live out. Like, exactly. I think they could actually, you know, sort of pay for themselves ecologically without being slaughtered. So yeah, I can, you know, I think we can de-emphasize, I think we can have this conversation very civilly.
Good. Just to wrap this up.
Without wanting to scratch each other's eyes.
Exactly.
Like,
well, there's no point in that. Because we want to move forward.
Yes.
And the only way to do that, I believe, is with love.
Yes.
Okay. It's not with anger. It's not with hate. We have to move forward with love. Love is the only answer, everybody.
Agreed. And as I put in that piece way back in 2010 or whenever that was, you know, 98% of our production or 99% of our production is this awful factory model. And so I think we can ally to stop that. And then we can have our big philosophical and moral debates about killing animals when that happens.
Okay.
But right now we agree that we're living in this nightmare world.
Yes. So there are solutions. You talk about them in your book. I recommend people read Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. And we also take a deep breath together and hope that we can see some positive change, especially on November 3rd, everybody.
And I actually weirdly do have a lot of hope for that, and that I don't think that the next regime necessarily, you know, if it comes to pass, will be focused on, you know, let's go back to normal, because I don't think that's going to be one of the options that they have.
Right. Okay. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today, Tom Philpott, author of Perilous Bounty.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Yeah, stay well, keep writing, and we'll continue the fight.
Yes.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Tom Philpott, and that was pretty amazing. I can't recommend enough the book Perilous Bounty, and I do hope you get the opportunity to pick it up and read it. And if you do, let me know what you think. Let's have a conversation about it. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And now I'm going to bring on the Gary DeMattei.
Karen, it's been so long since I've been here with you on the show.
Gary, where have you been?
I just can't believe how busy you've been with all of these incredible guests like Tom and everyone else.
I talked to Nava Atlas a couple of weeks ago and Marisa Wolfson Miller.
Oh, that was great too.
Yeah, with the kids. And their Veg-Educated cookbook.
The book is incredible.
Yes, it's very helpful, I think. Very helpful. Not enough of those kind of books out there. And then last week, I talked to Jay Morris Hicks,
who used to work for Ralph Lauren.
What's interesting, because I read Jay Morris Hicks' book, Outcry, And then this week, I read Tom Philpott's book, Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. And they're both kind of gloom and doom books because the world we're living in is kind of gloomy and doomy.
It is. So we should enjoy ourselves while we can.
But they both had solutions. And J. Morris Hicks's solution was a little, I don't want to be judgmental about it. I think it was very utopian.
Right.
And his utopia may not be the same as other people's utopia.
Right.
And that's where the problem lies.
So the bottom line for all of these books is eat less meat.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, even Marisa's book.
Well, Marisa's book, all the recipes are vegan.
Right. And so start your children on a vegan diet.
Yes. Eating fruits and vegetables, whole foods,
grains.
Yes.
Seeds,
good
nuts,
point, Gary.
And start them young. I think it was a great series of interviews to answer your question about where have I been. You have logged in lots of interview hours, and there's no time for fluff when you're talking about this serious stuff.
Yeah.
And I come on and add a little bit of levity, a little fluff to the heavy proceedings. Although, you know, you have a lot of interviews that are light. Nava's interview was great, and Maurice's interview was great. Lots of fun. The message underneath is the same. Let's switch to a plant-based diet. Let's stop eating meat because that's destroying the planet. Not to mention these poor animals that are being slaughtered by the billions.
Exactly.
And the water that's being used to grow food, to feed animals, to then kill and feed people. And that seems to be the problem, especially with Tom's book, right? Because he talks about how the salad bowl of the world, or basically of America, is Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the fruits and vegetables, lettuce, and all of the things that humans eat are grown in one place, California. While these other places that are perfectly fine for growing fruits and vegetables and is only growing produce
corn and soy.
For animals.
To feed animals. Right.
And they're not really taking care of the soil, and they're using lots of pesticides and herbicides, and the topsoil is washing away and flooding and going down the Mississippi River and causing all kinds of pollution to the drinking water and to the fish and to life. And
yes,
I mean, the ecosystem.
It's a mess.
So what are some of the solutions? Well, number one, I guess, is
we have to eat less meat. I want to say stop eating meat, but at least eat less, right?
Yeah. But when you ask people who eat meat that write these books, why don't you stop eating meat? They don't have an answer, right?
No. Well, I asked Tom, just like I told him I had asked Christopher Leonard and Ted Genoese, who wrote other books similar in theme about how we grow food and how unsustainable it is. And all of them focused on raising animals to some degree. And I would ask each of them, and you eat meat. And why is that okay?
Right.
Now, what Tom said, he didn't exactly answer the question, but he was saying we need to raise animals in a sustainable way. And that means getting rid of factory farms, getting rid of confined animal feedlot operations, letting animals pasture graze, which takes up a lot more land per animal. So you cannot grow the quantity of animals that we're growing today. So people ultimately have to eat less.
And a lot of people are afraid not to eat meat because they're afraid that they're not going to be satisfied.
Mm. Oh, please.
But we're here to say, at Responsible Eating and Living, that's all a bunch of crap, right?
That's right.
That's a big festering manure lagoon full of crap.
Bull crap. Yeah, anyway, so Tom talked about acknowledging that things need to change and that we need to eat less meat, maybe use it as a flavor or a garnish and not have the quantity. He was suggesting that Americans could eat 2/3 less going
from, one meal a day.
I guess so.
So if you have 3 meals a day and each of your meals contains meat, he's saying stick to 1 meal a day with meat.
Okay.
So that's like vegan before 6.
Right.
So that's like breakfast and lunch are vegan, and then dinner, throw on a steak on the barbie and do that stuff. And I'm saying you don't need to do that.
Of course not. I'm saying it too, Gary.
Well, not with the food that we prepare, at any rate.
So
my solution is learn how to cook.
There's a solution, Gary.
Right?
Got the answer that said, the reason why it's okay to eat meat is because. I didn't hear that.
No, and I think he's a smart man, and he realizes that there is no good reason to eat meat other than you like
you
the
like
taste,
it.
You like the way it tastes, yeah. and you're addicted to it. Because he a lot of people I know are addicted to meat. They can't give it up. Yeah. They say they can't. I used to think that too.
Yeah.
Until I met you.
He did say that once we get to the point of a more sustainable future where we're not growing so many animals and we realize that we can survive without them, then we can address the moral question of whether we should or should not be eating them.
Well,
okay.
I think that there isn't going to be a future. We're not going to have enough time based on a lot of the interviews that I've listened to in this program. That we're running out of time and we need to do something now, because what's going to happen if we can't even grow food to feed animals? Because there's...
Exactly. Well, one of the things we talked about in his book was the Great Flood in California. And according to the studies and the science and the research that's been done on the history of California going back hundreds and hundreds of years, these floods have been happening. And to some degree, bigger than the Great Flood in 1861, 1862. And there's another one due any moment now.
And that's in the Central...
Central Valley. But and not only would that be devastating to all the people and animals who live there, but our food supply for the entire country and other parts of the world would be dramatically reduced.
So the thing to do is to eat less meat, stop factory farming, stop monocropping, and start planting
and more food. More diverse types of food need to be grown all around the country.
Organic farming needs to be the rule of
yeah.
the day, and stop using herbicides and pesticides and all of the horrible things that are polluting the water and poisoning people when they eat them.
So California has a great climate. You know that. You love the weather there. You don't like the weather really anywhere else. It's so moderate most of the year.
Right. If you like 70 degrees 9 months out of the year and 3 months, it's lots of hot.
And the plants love it.
Yeah.
The growing season is outstanding.
Well, it's very similar to when I went to Italy.
It's a Mediterranean climate.
And I went to Italy. I could tell why many of the Italians in my family moved to California. It's very California-like, especially northern Italy where my people are from. So I can see that. And, you know, the things they grow in Italy and the south of France is very similar to what they grow in California.
Mm-hmm.
And that Mediterranean climate is very California-like. But now California has its own problems with climate change because of these fire seasons.
This is a time where we need dramatic change, not only in agriculture. We need dramatic change in our government. We need a dramatic change in life. We don't want to go backwards.
No.
No.
So what are some of the other solutions? Do we have any? Are we all going to have to start looking for ways to make our own food? Start canning again? Start growing little victory gardens like they did during World War II, where everybody, where they ran out of food during World War II because they were sending it all overseas? What can you do if you want to get food that isn't tainted with pesticides and herbicides? And we try to buy as much organic as possible. We don't eat anything that isn't organic. But what if that stops?
Sure, because a lot of our food's from California.
What are people going to have to do?
We need to grow food in other places and support our local farmers as much as we can. I don't have the answers.
It's like Long Island, for example. Lots of farms on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Long Island grows a lot of food. We've gone to several farms out on Long Island, organic farms, Golden Earthworm. We like taking a trip out there this time of year because you said I don't like the weather in New York, but the weather this time of year is
autumn.
Incredible. I love the weather.
Autumn here is perfect.
We need to encourage farmers in other parts of the world to start growing fruits and vegetables because they can, and not just
animal feed.
Animal feed.
There are solutions, and there are plenty of pockets of areas where people are regenerating their local soil that's been traumatized by the way it's been treated for decades. There's a lot of exciting things happening. And then there's all this urban farming where people are growing things in raised beds and on rooftops and along sides of walls. Yeah. We can get really creative.
In Brooklyn, there are lots of rooftop little gardens going on. And I know that that's a thing in Brooklyn, probably in Queens as well, and in Manhattan. Now, that isn't going to sustain an entire population of America, but every little bit helps, right?
Yeah. We talked about this before. I mentioned Will Bonsall a bunch of times, and he's got this veganic farm up in New England. I forget where he is. And he's a bit eccentric, but we could learn a lot from him and other people like him. And he explained this concept, and I'm going to explain it again because I think about it a lot, where we grow food in a certain place, we sell that food, and other people all over the world eat it. And then the process, they use the food in their bodies and they breathe it out and they poop it out and whatever. But that food that was grown in a certain location with certain resources is depleted because that product left and went somewhere else. And in California, water literally is being exported in the form of alfalfa. And it goes overseas to China to feed animals. And almonds, the water is in the almond. And it goes to other places and it doesn't return.
Right.
And that happens with all the food. All the fruits that are filled with water go somewhere else and don't get put back.
Into the earth.
Yeah, it's a big imbalance.
So there are no solutions. We're all doomed.
No, we're not. We have to focus and keep things more local.
We have to eat less meat.
And eat less meat.
And you have to go to Responsible Eating and Living for delicious recipes so that you will never want to eat meat again. I don't know how many times you and I have cooked for people and they have always said consistently, and we've cooked for crazy meat eaters who have said, if being a vegan tasted like this all the time, I would switch in a second.
Yes.
So how do we teach the world to cook?
Well, you know, you and I are doing what we can.
Right, that's what I'm saying. How do you and I teach the world?
I'd like to teach the world to cook
vegan. Yeah. No, I mean, we just had, okay, it's Taco Tuesday around here, and we just made the greatest tacos.
We love tacos, and these are the best we've ever had ever, right?
Yeah, you just made some incredible tortillas out of Japanese sweet potatoes and purple Stokes sweet potatoes and cassava flour. They were magnificent, and we used a cheese.
It's an almond ricotta.
It's an almond ricotta that... I would stand it up against anybody's goat cheese and anybody's soft cheese, anybody's farmer cheese. I mean, it was delicious. Grilled bell peppers, red bell peppers, grilled red onions, grilled tofu, guacamole. It was an amazing feast. And you don't even think about killing animals.
Oh, no.
When you eat this type of food. It's just delicious. And it's so easy and so clean and so delicious and satisfying.
Can we say it again? It was so delicious.
It's delicious.
We don't usually have the almond ricotta in our tacos.
No, but...
And that was the magic secret. Well, it was all good.
As soon as I put this thing together, I said, yeah, I could sell this off a food truck. I mean, I could see a line of people. So that's the solution. You and I buy a food truck and travel all over America...
And feed America.
Feed America.
Yeah.
We're going to need a couple of food trucks.
Okay. Anybody got some food trucks they want to unload?
Yeah. Hey, you think that's a great idea, everybody? Let us know. We're going to start looking for a food truck. And you'll see us in your neighborhood soon. And then we could teach classes. We could get people.
Yes.
We could entertain. We could sing and dance.
Of course. sing and dance on top of the food truck.
We could do that.
I've talked about making tortillas before. This was the first time I made purple sweet potato tortillas.
Big hit.
I always wanted
to. Big hit. Where's the applause sign?
Woo! Yeah. But it's so nice to have tortillas of different colors.
It's a tortilla of a different color. That's great. A tortilla of a different color. What a great slogan. We just gave it away.
Now, I also want to share what I did with the tofu today because I thought it was pretty ingenious.
The tofu was great.
We have a cast iron grill that we put on top of a gas stove. And it has the ridges so you can get the grill marks.
Ruffles has ridges.
And I put the bell peppers and the onions on there and I realized I'm out of room and I want to get this dinner moving. Right. So I had this vision of tofu strips like we've had at a Mexican restaurant in Los Gatos, California called Andale. So I sliced the tofu in thin strips and I was going to grill them. But I was out of real estate on the grill. So I baked them and I thought, once they've got a little skin on them, yeah, a little light golden toughness on the outside, then I'll put them on the grill when the vegetables are done.
Yeah, you're going to have to post a picture of
worked
all the folks
so
at home.
Well, and the tofu didn't stick because sometimes when you put fresh tofu on the grill and you're not coating it with
olive oil,
an inch of oil, they're going to stick, but they didn't stick this way. Oh, I was so pleased.
You brushed it with a little lime juice too.
A little lime juice,
yeah. Yeah, they gave it a nice flavor.
Yes.
That's delicious. A little Taco Tuesday action here at Eating and Living Headquarters.
The thing we didn't have
was
the tomatillo salsa, but I want to talk about it because it's a new recipe that we added a couple of weeks ago.
Up on the Responsible Eating and Living homepage, tomatillo salsa in preparation. Delicious. I had never made tomatillo salsa before, but again, at Andale and other Mexican restaurants throughout my life, I have had tomatillo salsa. And I love it. I love it. They put some habaneros in there. They put some jalapenos in there. Whatever you can do. But I've never made it myself. I've made a lot of salsa in my life, but never tomatillo salsa. And you bought some tomatillos the other day.
Well, they had them from the place we get our organic produce delivered. And it's a seasonal thing. And they had it available, organic tomatillos. So I'm like, okay.
Let's try
I'll buy them.
We don't have a grill. I know the really cool way to do it is you get your grill, you fire it up, your outdoor grill, and you throw your tomatillos on there, you throw your peppers on there, you throw your onions and all of the other things, and you roast them outdoors on the grill. We don't have it. We can't barbecue out here in Forest Hills on our terrace. So we did it under the broiler, and it's awesome. It's an awesome salsa. We did not have that for our Taco Tuesday lunch.
No, I know, but it's still worth talking about.
But
and it's so beautiful. The colors are so beautiful.
What a great addition that would be to this great lunch that we had.
So speaking of tortillas,
yes.
I think we need to wrap this up.
Ah! Your dad would be proud of that one.
Yeah. Okay, so I just want to toast to our Taco Tuesday extraordinaire.
Right.
And I really recommend people making their tortillas, making the almond ricotta.
Going vegan.
I hear some people, it's too much trouble. It's not. It's so worth it.
Go out and buy Tom Philpott's book and go vegan.
Yes, go vegan. Read the book. Let's all get together and talk about changing the world a little bit
more. Yeah, let's stop this insanity of factory farming and killing animals. And let's all go out and stop monocropping. Not wash the soil away, which is full of toxins and polluting everything everywhere.
That's it. That's all we need to do.
Let's just stop all that. This is nonsense. We don't have to do this anymore.
And the amazing thing is, as soon as we do stop, the earth is amazingly regenerative and will come back to vibrant health.
Yes.
Quickly.
I believe that.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. It's me, Karen Hartglass, and Gary DeMattei with another episode of It's All About Food. Thanks for joining us. And
have a delicious week. Thank you.